Hello and welcome to CX Conversations. This is your host, Vivek, bringing you CX lessons from CX leaders from around the world. Today, I'm going to be talking about how to craft your unique company culture and experience. I learned the importance of company culture the hard way, some through my experiences as an employee, and many more through my experience as a founder. I'm sure that every founder worth his or her salt would agree that culture can make or break a company. Getting your culture right is neither the easiest thing nor a priority for most organizations. But what if I told you that there is a way to craft a unique company culture and therefore deliver a unique experience to your employees and customers? Helping us understand how this can be done is our guest today, Karen Jaw Madsen. Karen is the author of Culture Your Culture, Innovating Experiences at Work, released in June 2018. She is also principal at CO, Design of Work Experience, or DOWE, that's D-O-W-E, pronounced as DOWE, which is quite an interesting name. Karen started her career with non-profit organizations and later advanced to HR executive leadership through Lockheed Martin, Schering Plough, which is now Merck, and SC Johnson. Karen and I connected through a common friend, and I couldn't have been happier to host her on this podcast. Karen, welcome to CX Conversations.
Thank you. I'm excited to speak with you and with your audience.
Thank you. Let me first congratulate you on the book release. The title is just amazing. Culture, Your Culture. It tells you what the book is all about. I'm curious, what made you write this book, Karen?
Well, the book was really an avenue by which I could share the design of work experience framework. So creating it was born out of this frustration, actually several frustrations, one of which is how often culture is blamed for the failure of companies after the fact when there is no definitive tool for creating culture on the front end. And another, seeing many other books out there either providing cultural archetypes that people didn't know how to achieve or a lot of one large case studies. So I call those How We Did It books. So Culture, Your Culture is a contribution to try to push the field forward.
Yeah. That sounds like it's a field book for people who really want to craft a culture.
Yes, absolutely. Those that are serious about it. So this book isn't for people that don't care about culture or don't care about their employees. It's for those that really want to leverage culture as an asset as well as their people.
That's wonderful. Tell us about DOWE.
Well, DOWE, and that's shorthand for Design of Work Experience because that's a mouthful. It's a framework, model, and process all rolled into one. And the only way to fully appreciate DOWE is to experience it. But I do my best in writing the book and in talking to people like you. But the model itself is a combination of design and change processes enabled by engagement and capability throughout. So those are the four main components of Design of Work Experience. But I can certainly dig into a little bit more about what that looks like if you're interested.
Yeah, it would be best if you could take us through a step-by-step process of how an organization can use DOWE to design its unique culture and experience.
Yeah, sure. I can walk you through that. Let me start by saying that it's, as you mentioned, it's about creating a custom design for the intended context. So not like others, not copying others, but for your unique company. So I really am trying to teach companies and organizations how to leverage and sustain their culture as a differentiating business asset. And at the same time, you're building teams and environments where both people and business thrive. So let me just get into it. So I mentioned the four main components. You dig into them a little bit deeper, and it's organized as a series of five phases. Those are understand, create and learn, decide, plan, and implement. Those are the five phases. And then if you dig in even deeper into detail, each of those phases are organized as a series of progressive learning loops. So each of them have very defined specific activities that enable you to design, implement, and sustain culture.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So what goes on into understanding?
So understand provides that deep understanding of the current state. So so the output of that first phase is a culture study. It's a deep dive into the complexities of what's understood and maybe not understood about the current state. And in your field, in customer experience, and in design thinking, that's about doing the user research that's required to really become intimate with the current experiences, and the understanding of the motivations and the touch points and all the things that maybe are givens or taken for granted. They need to be looked at in a way that you're truly researching an organization.
While on the customer experience side, there are some tools like customer journey mapping and whatnot, for which is used for developing an understanding about the customers.
Yes. We have those.
Yeah, too. I was just going to say, like, do you have some tools or things that people can use?
Absolutely. So there's quite an extensive appendix at the end of the book with lots of templates and toolkits and even a primer on change management for those that are new to it. What I tell people is I didn't hold anything back with this book. I put everything I could into it, but tried to keep it in this concise 200 pages. I do have lots of tools. Understand is it's not just about this phase, and this research is not just about doing things in a very defined way. It's also about kind of the curating the right methodologies that is needed to capture the data that you're trying to get to.
All right. And what kind of outcomes must one expect when they are at the tail end of the understand phase?
So what comes out of it is what is called a culture study. It's actually a narrative that's created out of that research. And the output of it, really, it's not just the document itself, but the intimacy or the depth of understanding about a culture. Those that are doing this work end up being so close to understanding the nuances of the organization that they really become experts in and of themselves of that particular culture.
Interesting. And then the next phase is?
Create and learn. So that combines learning and the creative design process to uncover new possibilities. So this is when the process diverges, and it's intended to allow for the innovation to happen, to generate and push boundaries that perhaps never were attempted before, to be able to play with new ideas and to be able to experiment and learn through play and in collaboration with others. So in the field of architecture, you have kind of these design charrettes where you kind of bring in all the mind hives and you work and leverage them to be able to kind of bring in the diversity of thought and tinker with new concepts. So that's what create and learn is all about.
And it looks like I was looking at the diagram that represents do we as a process.
Oh, yes.
It looks like create and learn is like a loop.
It is. So it is meant to be iterative. The entire process is iterative, but particularly in this phase, it is especially iterative. So there are three learning loops in this process. And it's intended to be able to kind of loop back if you need to in a progressive way. That's how learning happens, right? You kind of move forward and then loop back and then reflect and adjust and then move forward again. So the three learning loops that are part of this phase are explore, brainstorm, and play. So everything I just described to you.
All right. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. And then comes decide, right?
Yeah, so decide is where the process converges. So where we diverged in create and learn, we converge in decide. and we iterate toward the selection of solutions and the creation of what I call the design blueprint. So through all the process, and these all build upon each other. So by the time you get to decide, you actually have the criteria as the decision-making tool based on the user research to know, okay, what solutions are best meeting all sets of criteria. And those are the ideas that you pursue. So it's not about who gets to decide or what the loudest voice in the room gets to go with. It's really about taking an almost scientific approach based on qualitative research about what is absolutely going to meet the needs or the unmet needs.
Great. So I'm just going to take a step back and just so that I'm understanding this correct. So we're going to go back to the first phase, which is understand, where we are doing user research and who are we researching? Are these, like, if we are talking about company culture, we are researching our employees. We are trying to understand their behaviors and their ambitions and needs. And then basis that we are crafting a certain promised land out of which we are creating using design process and learning out of that. So, and then finally deciding which is the best blueprint that will take us further ahead, right?
Yeah, for the most part, I would expand on that first piece around what we're researching. It's it is employees, but it is in their context. So okay. It is, so in the book I described, there's, in addition to the people, there's all these aspects that make up the context. And so it's not just the people, it's the people within their environment.
Okay. That makes more sense.
Yeah. So business strategies count. That's part of the context, you know, and their climate, that's part of the climate is not necessarily tied directly to an individual, but it is part of something that's organizationally shared. So those are examples of the types of aspects that are looked at as part of this work. But there's business factors, the culture itself, the starting culture, the environment, the behaviors, the experiences. So right now I'm just kicking off a project with a client and I'm asking for whatever they can give me. And there are pieces that they may not expect that culture would be a part of, but they are. And so making sure that we're not doing this for fun, we're actually making sure that we're creating success for both the business and the people.
That's interesting. And that also reminds me of one of the clients that I'm working with. And this is a startup, which has a fleet of EV electronic vehicles running as a cab service for corporate employees. And these guys are, so we are helping them collect feedback responses from their drivers. So these drivers, this company calls their drivers as partners, so service partners. And they are conducting, so you can imagine these are drivers who have a very different socioeconomic background, and they have a different approach to their life and what they expect out of the company that is employing them as drivers. Obviously, they are doing a wonderful job of training these guys with the electronic vehicles and all of the technology that is being implemented across the fleet. But they also, this company is investing in understanding much more about the aspirations, the context, like you mentioned, of their service partners. Great. So that they are able to then craft the right kind of environment for these guys to thrive and grow within the organization.
Yeah, you got to create the ecosystem by which these intentions can thrive, you know, can happen.
Wonderful. So let's move on to the next step, which is after decide comes plan, right?
Yep. And plan prepares the organization for the implementation of the design blueprint. And the result of that phase is a roadmap and action plans. So this phase is intended, and it's the first part of the change management, the change process that goes into saying, okay, there's a distance between where we are today and where we want to be, and this is how we're going to get there. And that's all that work in preparing for that implementation happens during plan.
Wonderful. And then comes the implementation phase.
Yes. So implement is the actual change management. So you're both managing the narrative and implementing the plans, right? So there's a lot of things going on, but it's the actual transformation of that intentionally designed future. So that's kind of what the implementation is all about. And the last learning loop of the implement phase is actually called sustain, because that's the one loop that many organizations tend to forget when it comes to change. They implement and then they move on to the next project and they think it's going to stick. And sustain is something that needs to assure that those changes stick around for as long as you need them. So it's not intended to be permanent. I mean, organizations are living and breathing entities, but you need to make sure that whatever changes and the kind of culture that you want to realize ends up being what it is for the foreseeable future, as you plan it to be, right?
True, and that's a great statement over there. I heard someone say that organizations are living organisms. So you got to nurture them and do things to sustain whatever you're building in that. Because I can completely see that is perhaps going to be the point which will decide whether whatever you have done so far will live or it will die. So what are some of the things that an organization can do to sustain this change?
Yeah, well, part of it is making sure that there's enough momentum driven behind it. And why it's a learning loop is if you go through all this planning and implementation and then you find that the momentum's still not there, you got to go back in that process. You got to iterate again and go through those steps to make sure that that's there. So that's the first piece of sustain, is to making sure that you have that momentum. And that might mean making sure that you're setting up the infrastructure. It might mean creating entities that will be there to help manage or own going forward. It might be planning for the next stage in their maturity level. So maybe this ends up being just phase one. It depends on the size and the complexity of the organization. But sustain is making sure, as I said, that they stick around as long as they need to be. So being able to make sure you, if necessary, re-enroll people, re-examine the plans, revisit them, and then be able to measure. So that's part of the planning process, is to be able to establish how you're going to measure for success. And those data points are going to give you the feedback you need to go back and say, okay, what do we need to tweak? How do we make sure that we deliver on what we promise? Because when you go through all this degree of engagement and co-design with your employees, you can't just walk away from it and then, you know, expect people to be okay with that.
True. And when I'm hearing that, I'm also thinking, shouldn't there be some sort of feedback mechanism or a check?
Yes.
Or something that keeps checking, or that could be a governance structure or certain checks and balances in the place.
Or feedback loop even. I mean, just, I think a lot of organizations feel like communication is one-sided. It's about pushing out content, and it should be about cultivating a relationship with your employees that never existed before.
Wonderful. That's interesting. And I can imagine that a multinational company environment would pose a whole new challenge to crafting the company culture. Could you talk to us about how company culture plays into a multinational company environment?
Yeah. Or even distributed workforces. That's another question that's come up in the past, is what do we do when everyone's not in the same place? And in the case of a multinational company, the employees are coming from different national cultures or ethnic groups and different histories. And one of my last corporate jobs was working in the shared service centers around the world. And it's fascinating to see all these nationalities working together in one place when you know that some of these countries have a lot of history with one another, right? And what the research has shown is that if you craft and implement and sustain a company culture to the point where it's salient enough to actually overcome national differences. So company culture can be more salient than nationalistic cultures if the investment is made in doing so.
That's interesting. Yeah, and I remember my experience working with this company that my last employment was with in Amsterdam was also quite multicultural. And even my MBA was my first dose of a very multicultural environment. And it was amazing. It was almost transformative for each individual to be put in that context and given goals that each one of you work towards as a team, which is interesting. And while you're saying,
I'm sorry
that,
to interrupt, because speaks to the diversity discussion as well.
Yeah.
So what I've had to address is what's the difference between a shared culture and leveraging diversity, and they're not opposed to one another. People misunderstand that the shared cultural value, those cultural values are what you want to share. The diversity is what you want to leverage. That's everything else, right? So what you just talked about your experience in the Netherlands was kind of diversity at work, but you had this shared experience, didn't you? So you were bonded by that. So it's to me, they're not diametrically opposed. It's about what is shared and then what's leveraged as diversity. I want to make sure everyone knows the difference, because sometimes companies weaponize culture. They don't hire for diversity because they argue lack of a cultural fit. That's a misuse of culture.
That's interesting. Could you talk about how, or rather, let me just jump into my next question, because that is going to tell, I'm going to bring up the doubts that I have in my mind after you said that, after you answer this, because I'm also curious who would be responsible or should own this process of building the organization culture.
Well, everyone needs to own it. So this whole process is a co-design model. So everyone has a way of contributing to it, and everyone perpetuates, reinforces, or bucks the culture. So I don't feel that people understand the empowerment they actually have to contributing to the communities that they work in. Everyone needs to own it, to answer your question, but it must be initiated and championed by leaders, because people look to their leaders and they're watching them. And if they're not embodying the culture, then how do you expect other people to follow suit?
True. So is it then... the HR head that kind of or you kind of shy away from putting this in a functions basket?
Ultimately, buck will stop with the CEO. That's my opinion. Now, when you speak about HR, which in some companies that's where it resides, I've actually written an article which I'll share with you later, but you can put in the show notes for people. There's an article about the role HR should play when it comes to culture, and it's not to be the owner, because no one person can own the culture, that no one can wield that sword by themselves. But there are roles HR can play when it comes to culture. So I wrote an article about that.
Wonderful. And this is where I wanted to connect this with the previous statement that you had made, where you said that companies sometimes weaponize culture to in their hiring process. And that's where I think if we have someone who is the steward of this culture development activity or process in an organization, that person would then be responsible for making sure that that this is not happening. Am I right?
Theoretically, yes. In practice, it's not always the case, and I can point to many, many examples. And part of it is when people say culture fit, these are in organizations that actually haven't done the work to define an overt culture. It's shorthand for saying they're not like us, and that becomes a diversity problem. But especially if, you know, that hasn't been articulated. The point about being overt about a culture, and there's boundaries to that as well that I talk about in the book, because you can't say I'm on an evil culture, and that's okay. It's not okay. There's values behind everything. But the whole point behind it is that you have to be so overt about culture, and those experiences have to align with what's articulated to the point that people, it's very clear to people whether an environment is for them or not. And so it becomes, you know, much clearer understanding in between these part of a job search, somebody who's searching for a job. Is this the right company for me? Because those are huge decisions somebody has to make in their lives. And it's a lot easier if they understand the culture of a company, right? So that's kind of what I was talking about. I hear horror stories. I've seen it. I've experienced it myself. And that's why I feel that there is a need to disrupt the employee experience today. That's why this book is about innovating experiences at work, because by and large, people are unhappy at work and they're accepting or tolerating and putting up with something that's less than ideal, and vice versa. The companies that employ them are leaving all this untapped potential on the table. And in fact, by ignoring culture or not cultivating it, for as an asset, they're actually creating a liability for themselves. So there's lots of news headlines that we can point to. I mentioned earlier the after the facts, right? All these red flags about a culture and why something bad that happened could have been prevented and the culture pushed. So all those things out there.
Those are like postmortem reports.
Absolutely. And those are don't be this. And yet not enough companies understand how important this is. So everybody needs it. That's what I say. Half the people care about it, or half the companies care about it, and even fewer are willing to invest. And that's the space I play in.
As it is said, change starts with awareness, and I think you're doing a great job at that. So it looks like this would definitely impact a company's employee experience, the entire DEI process and the framework. What are some of the ways you think that the culture will also shape the customer's experience for that company?
Yeah. The way I see it is that culture and customer experience both influence and shape and reflect each other. Okay, so it's a symbiotic relationship. Customer experience is what people outside the organization or what's external to the company experiences. You know, that's the first face. That's the connection points between the company and the outside world. And those need to be aligned, right, in a way that says, okay, if we intend to be this kind of culture, then our customer experience should reflect it. But poor customer experience usually starts with poor employee experience, right? Because the expectations, the training even haven't been, and the work hasn't been done to make sure that a stellar customer experience happens. And I've actually posted about it on social media where, you know, companies are just so myopic in their views of customers or customers versus their products that it's just a complete disconnect. And at the end of the day, that creates bad reputations. So they shape, they reflect each other, and they shape each other. And there's so much, I think you and I spoke earlier about this, there's so much about customer experience that I encounter in my work when it comes to employee experience, right? The journey. helping people frame it as an experience to begin with, to change the mindsets around being customer or people-centered, right? So there are a lot of intersection points where what I'm doing and what you're doing are so hand in hand with one another. And so I think that's why there's so many synergies that can be taken with this kind of work.
I think setting a customer experience goal without doing the groundwork of improving your employees' experience and at least getting your employees' experience to the point where they can deliver the kind of customer experience that you wish to deliver to your customers. So I would say employee experience is the foundation on which you would lay the customer experience building.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's think about this in day-to-day life, right? So if an employee is miserable and they pick up the phone and speak with a customer, how do you think they're going to treat them? They're going to share the misery.
Have a bad day also.
Exactly. And vice versa, right? You've seen stellar examples of customer experience that reflects how happy people are to be working and to represent even.
They take pride in being part of their brand.
And it doesn't matter the level of the job even, you know. They don't need to be, you know, a high-powered executive. You know, it could be somebody on the front lines that could really thrive and want to thrive in that environment.
Yeah, mostly it has to be someone in the front line because that's where actually the customer experience is delivered.
That's true. Yeah, that you write the letters to the VP of customer experience when you get so upset.
True. All right, great. So time for some rapid-fire questions, Karen.
Okay.
Which business leader do you follow and what have you learned from him or her?
Oh, gosh. So are you speaking about specific executives and companies? Because I have actually a lot of intellectual heroes, thought leaders that I admire. The one that I admire the most is David Cooperrider, who is out of Case Western Reserve University, and he's the founder of Appreciative Inquiry. He's somebody that I admire the most as an intellectual.
And what have you learned from him?
I learned from him the appreciative mindset, and that's actually a big part of design of work experience as well. So it's not about solving problems. It's about creating the conditions where they can exist. So it's a different mindset about taking the strengths of an organization and leveraging them and leveraging opportunities as opposed to doing what we have always done is take a deficit-based approach or a problem-focused approach, in which case you end up creating new problems and you're never finished, right? So if you're setting the conditions where those problems can exist, that's a completely different mindset. So that's the thing I learned from Appreciative Inquiry. And there's so much of that that has inspired the work that I do in culture.
Wonderful. So which is the one book you would recommend someone and why, apart from your book, obviously?
I'll put it this way. There's a lot of books that I love. And actually, I posted about it for Academic Week this year. And there's one book I left off and I felt like I should have left it in. I actually forgot about it at the time, and it was a fiction book. It's The Alchemist. Have you read that one?
Yes, I have, and it's an amazing book.
Yeah.
And why would you recommend that to someone?
Well, it just, you know, anyone, it's a short read. It's actually.
And an easy one, actually. It's quite an interesting story, actually.
It is. And so there's so many themes that you can pull out of it. I mean, from the journey to appreciate, you know, and a total appreciation of that journey. The way he uses his words as a writer is amazing to me. But I really could not. I was asked to do this. I was asked by my publisher for Academic Book Week to share what one book that inspired me, and I ended up showing six. So I don't have one hero. I tend to find learning and inspiration wherever I can. So, yeah,
and that's why this is a difficult round, Karen.
It is. It really is. And it's not quite rapid fire, so I apologize for that.
Yeah, so next question. What is your advice for startup founders when it comes to building a company culture?
Oh, I love that question because I've been doing a lot of work in that space. I'm actually working on a larger article and then potentially even more on this question, because a lot of startup founders are focused so much on getting their business off the ground, as they should, but they forget to lay the foundational building blocks of their business. And what I mean by that is establishing mission, vision, values, culture. And that begins with the founding team. So ensuring that the culture that is and the team dynamics and the teamwork that is established in that founding team scales up in a way that's healthy and is supportive of that company's growth, as opposed to one that could erode it. So I've been working with a number of startups that some want to establish it up front, which is great. I mean, that says a lot about the foresight of the founders around it. But others have learned the hard way. They've come very close to, take their very promising products and to break up their company because the founding team can't get along, right? And then they realize they need to recontract. They have to establish that team charter to be their North Star moving forward. My advice for startup founders is make sure you create the space to establish your business. So it's not just your product. It's not just about getting your beta and getting funding and getting all, because if you don't set up the foundational building blocks, that's going to bite you later on. And I can tell you that from experience. And you can read about it in the newspaper too.
Yeah, definitely. It's all over the news. As much as we see news about successes, we see things, meteoric fails as well.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
I was just going to say that in short, for startup founders, the advice is that this too is work.
Yes.
Do it.
Yes. and you know, it actually takes a lot less time and effort than if you're dealing with a crisis situation. Think about it that way, right?
In crisis, nothing gets built.
Yeah. But yeah, people don't realize just and honestly, I'm in Silicon Valley. I'm trying to beat the drum on that when it comes to investors, because investors aren't always asking for that. They sometimes judge startups based on it, but they're not always setting those expectations up front, or they're not necessarily supporting the effort behind that, because they want to see, you know, the progress on the product, as an example, right? And so there's
the entire ecosystem needs to be more educated or aware about this thing.
Yes. Now, the good news is that it's not like people aren't aware of it, and it's not like people aren't talking about it. They are. But more action needs to be taken than what I'm seeing right now.
Definitely, there is some way to go forward, and this is awesome. With that, we've also come to the end of this podcast, Karen. It's been an amazing experience talking to you, and the pleasure was all mine. I would like to thank you once again for being a part of CX Conversations.
It was really great to talk with you too. I enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. It was amazing hosting you. And to all our listeners, this is Vivek signing off from CX Conversations. Until next time, bye.